twitter.com/KBOO.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/KBOO radio.
We also provide content to the Free Music Archive,
an interactive library of high-quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/KBOO.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
The Upbeat Radio Show, every fourth Sunday at 6:30 p.m., hosted by me, Freddie Ruiz Jr. I love playing positive, uplifting dance music. Whether you're in the car or just hanging out with friends, anytime is a good time to dance with KBOO.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Reverend Al Sharpton delivers the eulogy for Jordan Neely, a homeless African-American street artist who was choked to death after he cried out about his hunger on the New York City subway. The killer, ex-Marine accused of the on-camera killing, said he would do it all over again if he had the chance. And we'll feature the latest edition of the Electronic Intifada with Nora Bowers-Friedman. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. That's the People's Radio Network, non-corporate, no holds barred, truth to power every day. And we begin in New York City. Daniel Penny, the man who choked Jordan Neely to death on a New York City subway train on May 1st, has been charged with second-degree manslaughter in Mr. Neely's death. The charges on Friday came more than a week after the killing and after many politicians, city leaders, and activists called for Mr. Penny's immediate arrest. Mr. Neely's killing, they said, was an unnecessary tragedy that underscored the city's inadequate policies toward its most vulnerable and marginalized residents. So here now we present the mighty powerful eulogy presented by Reverend Al Sharpton. Listen to this.
Let me say as I begin that we should not celebrate Jordan's life, but we should not ignore how he died. This funeral was not on the schedule. We're not here because of natural causes. We're here because of unnatural policies. And I don't care who sits high until we address these policies. We will have to deal with Zachary and Mildred's mourning their loved one a long time.
That's right.
The book of St. Matthew's, 25th chapter, 35th verse said, I was hungry and you brought me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. May God add a blessing to the reading of his word. Why did I select that scripture? Because there has been, since Jordan's death, a distortion of values that we need to make clear that has been violated. When I first got the call about Jordan and later talked with Johnny Green, who is pastor here, and Johnny Green told me of how Jordan's mother was killed. And her funeral was right here. And Jordan sat right there and watched his mother funeralized, who'd been chopped up. And he'd never been the same. Jordan was not annoying someone on the train. Jordan was screaming for help. We keep criminalizing people with mental illness. People keep criminalizing people that need help. They don't need abuse, they need help. That is why I chose this scripture. Yes, Jesus said, I was hungry, uh-huh. Yes. And you fed me. Uh-huh. I was outdoors, you took me in. These are the principles you claim to live by.
Right.
I heard Reverend Green, and I have to, as a minister, deal with this. I heard the governor of Florida, DeSantis, say that the man that killed Jordan was a good Samaritan. Well, and they raised over $2 million for this man. Well, I know, Governor DeSantis, that you putting black history and LGBTQ and Latino out of the school. But I have a Bible to put in the governor's office. Because apparently you don't know what the Good Samaritan was. Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan. He said there was a man beaten and robbed, Aunt Mildred, and put by the side of the road. One man walked by that was of his same race and ignored him, and he kept walking. Another came that was holy, sanctified, full of piety, but he kept walking. Then came a man from another race who was a Samaritan, and Jesus said he stopped to help the man, and Jesus called him a good Samaritan. A good Samaritan helped those in trouble. They don't choke them out. What happened to Jordan was a crime. And this family shouldn't have to stand by themselves. These lawyers, Lennon Edwards and Dante, shouldn't have to stand by themselves. Because when they choked Jordan, they put their arms around all of us. All of us have the right to live. I was traveling and I watched the news, and I was telling Bishop Daughtry, who I grew up mentored by him. I was Jesse Jackson's youth director and his youth director since I was 12. That's right. And I was telling him that I remember in the late 80s, they killed a young black man in Howard Beach named Michael Griffin. And they ignored us. So we called a day outrage, and I jumped on the tracks, and we jumped and blocked the trains, and they gave me 45 days in jail. I hope y'all that jumped on the tracks, they don't give y'all the time I got. But what bothered me as one that has done that and will do it some more if I have to, is that they said they were looking for the other folk that jumped on the track, Senator Clair. What about looking for who let this guy go from the precinct? I want to know why they let him go after he killed an unarmed man that hadn't threatened anybody. Nobody hurt nobody jumping on the tracks. There was no violence in the protest. The violence is when you choked Jordan to death. You chasing the wrong people. You looking for the wrong people. Let me get this right. A boy is on the train screaming for help. May disturb you, may annoy you. A guy comes up from behind. Now, Lennon Edwards is smarter than me. Maybe he can explain it to me. How does somebody come up from behind and claim self-defense? He wasn't even in front. Behind. There was no weapons. There was no language. Nobody was threatened. And you grab them and put them in a chokehold. Two people help hold them down. And you go to the precinct and they let you go. If Jordan was impersonating Elvis Presley, if Jordan had been a different race and they had him impersonating Elvis, and a black guy put Elvis impersonated in a chokehold, and two black guys held him down, they would not have let that black guy leave the precinct that night. Zachary and Mildred and the family are not asking for favors. They want justice. Do what you would do for anybody else. And until you do, we're gonna stand with this family. They shouldn't have to stand up for themselves. Mildred told me on the phone, then I talked to the father, how Jordan impersonated Michael Jackson. Jackson told me he loved Michael. And many of you know I preached Michael's funeral. I committed Michael's body to his grave. He's come up to the House of Justice here in Harlem, worked National Action Network. Right. That's why I was glad my dance partner's here, AOC, me and her dance, and went viral in her office. Give her a hand. She stood up for Jordan. Despite whatever mental challenges he may have had, say that. He wanted to be something. He didn't want to be a drug dealer. He wanted to be Michael Jackson. He didn't want to be a thief or a crook. He wanted to be Michael Jackson.
He wasn't trying to be something negative. He wanted to be like Michael. That made the world smile and get on one beat. You didn't have the right to snatch the life out of this young man. The sad part about it, the sick part about it, is that he'd been choked much of his life. The agencies that failed to keep him and give him mental health choked Jordan. Those that let him go, even though they had his record of needing help, they choked Jordan. The city agencies choked Jordan. He'd been choked most of his adult life. He's an example of how you're choking the homeless, how you're choking the mentally ill, how you're choking all over this city. And we come to say this choking gotta stop. There must be, Jermaine Williams, sound policy on the homeless. Sound policy on the mentally ill.
Yeah, yeah.
Sound policy on how we deal with them. All of us have family members with mental illness. And something I'll never forget Zachary told me about his son is that he wasn't homeless, he was houseless. Because he had homes he could go to. He'd go to Aunt Mildred's and eat. He'd go and talk to his family. There's a difference between houseless and homeless. We come from good families. We come from people that love us. But sometimes things happen that drives us in the street. Don't look down on us. If you look down, only look down to lift us up. This jaded theology of the Good Samaritan. This jaded theology. How do you condemn folks coming to a country you invite them to? And don't teach and don't treat the ones that built the country right that's already here. God challenged me the other day about Lieutenant Governor Delgado talking about immigration policy. I said, it was hard for me to be against refugees. We've got to figure it out. But how do you preach against refugees and then talk about Jesus? The Bible tells me that an angel told Joseph to get the mother Mary and the baby Jesus and flee to Egypt. Because there's genocide getting ready to happen. And Jesus went to Egypt and North Africa and grew up in refuge, which made Jesus a refugee. You quote scriptures that you don't believe in. You preach doctrines that you don't live by. You hang up on the agencies of the city titles, but you don't have the function. You're not looking out for those mentally ill. You're not looking out for the homeless. You are somewhere with a big title and no function. And in the name of Jordan, we're gonna turn this city around to serve the homeless. Jordan, I didn't know you, Jordan. I know your aunt, and I've talked to your daddy. And one thing I promise is in your name,
We're going to change how they deal with homelessness. In your name. We're going to change how they deal with the mentally ill. In your name. We're going to change services in this city. Jordan, you didn't die for nothing. What they meant for bad, we'll make good. We're going to have a new city and new city services. Maybe it is time for the people to get up and stand up and hold us accountable. The mayor says we need to summit. Yeah, well, you can't summit without the Neely family. You can't summit without the advocates that's been advocating all along. You can't summit without Attorney Edwards. We got, yes, to have a summit of new policies, but they got to be enforced. We also need, and I'll take my seat, we need to also know who, you know, right after it happened, I jumped out and AOC jumped out and others and said, this is wrong, this man ought to be arrested. And they ought to bring before the grand jury the two guys that held him down. This is me now. I'm not speaking for nobody but me. I want to know who decided at the precinct to let this guy go home. I want to know who called the order that it was all right for this man to choke this brother to death and go home and sleep in his bed. Who gave the order that it was all right to release him? We can't live in a city where you can choke me to death with no provocation, no weapon, no threat, and you go home and sleep in your bed while my family got to put me in a cemetery. There must be equal justice under the law. So if we look angry, we are. But we're not mad. Difference between going mad and being angry. Yes, we're angry. Because we're at another funeral we shouldn't have had to be at. Yes, we're angry. Because you see our children as objects rather than human. Yes, we're angry. Because you keep choking us to death rather than leaving, living, and building, and building, and building us up. And we won't stop till we change this nation. We won't stop till we change this city. We won't stop until the Jordans get help. When they scream, we're gonna help them, not choke them. We're gonna stand up. There'll be no justice. There'll be no peace.
You're listening to Flashpoints, Al Sharpton memorializing the latest victim of sort of American two-gun, out-of-control violence. This one happened on the subway. Of course, Jordan Neely, a homeless African-American street artist who was known. He was known to the city. He was appreciated. Unbelievable. Al Sharpton making that amazingly powerful point about if it was an Elvis look-alike impressionist, I don't think he would have been murdered there on the subway. Anyway, you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Some of you are going to hear now the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barros Friedman, and others will hear a little bit more from me and my good brother Miguel Gavilan Molina. Stay with us.
case of Palestine, the Zionists wanted to replace the Palestinians, want to expel them. They don't want them around at all, serving them or not serving them.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman.
And I'm Asa Winstanley.
Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Today, we're delighted to have author, academic, and physician Ghada Karmi back on the show to talk about the 75th anniversary of the beginning of the Nakba and her new book, One State, The Only Democratic Future for Palestine Israel. Karmi was born in Jerusalem and was among the 800,000 Palestinians who were forcibly expelled from Palestine in 1948. Ghada Karmi's work includes books that have been instrumental in both my and Asa's early political education, In Search of Fatima and Married to Another Man, and her new book, I'm sure, will join those earlier counterparts. Ghada Karmi, welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Hello.
So before we get into your new book, which examines the one-state future in Palestine, we wanted to talk about the timing. We're up against the 75th year of the beginning of the Nakba, the act committed by Zionists of forced expulsion and ethnic cleansing of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in 1948 when Israel declared itself a state, an act that continues to this day. Can you talk about your experience of the Nakba? What happened to you and your family 75 years ago?
Well, you have to understand, first of all, that this, what I'm going to say, is my view of things as a child, as a child who also did not understand what was going on. All that I knew was that, as from the beginning of 1948, schools were closed. My school was closed, so I couldn't go to school. I was a primary school at that time, but everything closed down. Increasingly, as the early months of 1948 advanced, more and more what I would call abnormalities crept into my life. So it's bad enough that I didn't go to school, but increasingly, we were really restricted from going out at all, because there's a good reason for that. Jewish snipers had taken up positions inside empty houses, that is, houses whose families had already left, you know, thinking that, as you do in time of troubles, that to take the children away for safety. Now, those houses were used by these snipers, and they just took, I mean, they shot at people walking along the street. So everybody scuttled in, for me, as a child, it wasn't that I really understood any of this, but I understood that my parents were scared, and that scared me. It was an inchoate fear, and so it went on getting more and more abnormal until April 1948, which is when my parents decided had to evacuate us to somewhere safe while, quote, things died down, unquote. And that was it. I never saw my homeland as it had been again. I've been back, but it's not the same place. So it's a very shocking, very traumatic. And I really think that Palestinians should face the fact that this was a massive trauma, and really, it's very difficult to recover from something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk a little bit about your house.
you discovered almost 20 years ago that the New York Times was in, or rather on top of, your childhood home. You received a call from the Times bureau chief, Stephen Erlinger, in 2005. He read your memoir, In Search of Fatima, and invited you to visit your own home. Can you talk about that surreal experience and what it says about how Palestinian property and lives have been either erased as villages were razed, or up for grabs to foreign settlers and even bureau chiefs of a major news outlet?
That's right. And now, in fact, our house had been a villa, which is on one floor. There was no other floor. So at some subsequent point, somebody had built an upper story, and it became the New York Times bureau chief's residence in Jerusalem. What a coincidence. Now, Erlinger actually found my email address, don't know how, but he got in touch, and he said exactly that. I think I'm living above your house, etc. And would you like to come and visit? So I couldn't possibly have resisted, because I really had to see it. So I went, and apart from actually going into the house, the thing that really was pretty striking was that he, Erlinger, was at pains to be nice to me and to admire, you know, praise my book and things like that, and then to tell me that the family, Israeli family living in our house, are terribly nice people, and they really very understand, and they're very happy for you to look round. And I remember saying to him, hang on, you now know what you do know. You've read my memoir. You're now living above my old house, which has different people living in it. Has that changed your view of Israel at all? He looked embarrassed. He tried to change the subject. And in my conversation with him, again and again, I came back to this point. I said to him, you know what happened. Why do you not say, how is it possible that it wouldn't change your view of Israel? You can see you're here because I'm not here. So doesn't that mean anything? He was evasive to the end. And I did go and look at my house, which was not our house. I mean, it was dead, really. All the soul in it had gone. And these people were using it. You know, I mean, they were nice enough. I'm not saying anything else. But it was really a very sad, uncomfortable experience for me.
Yeah, it must have been unbearable.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. The stories in your book, In Search of Fatima, are so striking. And, you know, you're left with this immense sense of loss in your memoir, you know, this sort of stark facing up to the reality of a Palestine that is gone forever, in a sense, that, you know, even should Palestine be restored at some point in the future, well, let's be optimistic and say when Palestine is restored at some point in the future, it won't be the same Palestine, and there's no going back in time, and that Palestine will, you know, in the future would be something different. So, I mean, on that note, let's get into your book, your new book. This here it is, One State, the Only Democratic Future for Palestine and Israel. And it's kind of an extension of an earlier book you wrote, Married to Another Man, on a similar topic. And it's not the first book on the One State solution. And our colleague Ali Abul Nema, of course, he wrote a book about 20 years ago. And you reference his work and the work of others extensively in your new book. And you write in the introduction, quote, "A shared state is the only way this impasse will end, not because it is wanted by either side, but because it is inevitable. It is the contention of this book that the logic of the situation before us must lead to the formation of one democratic state in place of the current ethnocentric apartheid state of Israel." And you add at the end another quote, "Israel was created and maintained against the logic of history, and the same historical logic will dictate its inevitable ending." So this is all from the introduction. So Rada, tell us a bit more about why you wrote this book and what the current moment can show us in terms of this inevitability that you talk about in the introduction.
Well, look, my primary motivation was knowing that the 75th anniversary of Israel was coming up. I actually wanted to look ahead, to look forward, rather than mourn the past. Of course we mourn the past, we always will. But really, it's high time that we used our energies to inquire, discuss, search for the future. And for me, of course, and I think for all Palestinians, the future means the return of Palestine. Now, how that return will happen, what it will amount to, these are things that need to be addressed. And that was the primary motivation for the book. Now, when I said that it was inevitable, I really meant that. It wasn't wishful thinking, because it's in the logic of the situation that you have an oppressor who knows no other language except violence and oppression, and you have an oppressed people. And you can get away with this for a long time, and you can see Israel's done quite well in so many decades, where it's been able to commit all kinds of crimes and get away with it. But it cannot go on forever. That situation does not go on forever. It never has historically. So that's what I meant by inevitable. Because the subject people rise up again and again, ineffectively at first, but as time goes on, they get more and more effective. And the oppressor, having no tools other than oppression, will increase their oppression. So that dialectic of even more violence from the oppressor and resistance by the oppressed will eventually lead to a very different and new situation. Now, of course, I do not suggest that when this happens and there is a sort of chaos, I'm not suggesting that suddenly out of this there will emerge this state quickly. It won't. There will be a period of bloodshed, of extreme chaos and violence. But then out of this will come the shape of the future state, a state which no way can it be a state for one side entirely, and certainly not for Jews. And where, you know, Palestinians have to, as I've said in the book, you know, they have to accept, bitter as it is for them, that to live with what was the oppressor yesterday, and people who have a racist attitude towards them and feel themselves to be superior, it's very, very difficult to get to people who've suffered so much to say, all right, I will live with you. But there is no alternative. There is a Jewish community living in what was Palestine, and what are you going to do with them? You're not going to kill them. You're not going to throw them in the sea. So, of course, you have to live together. And I suppose what I'm suggesting, which most reasonable people would suggest, is the way you live together will be in a democracy where everybody is represented equally, irrespective of their origin, race, gender, etc.
One of the parallels that is often made, of course, is South Africa, but... Yeah. And there are, you know, there's certainly similarities. But what do you make of the less commonly made parallel of Algeria, where what do you think of the similarities there? Do you see any similarities with what happened with Algeria, in the sense that the French settler colonists were offered citizenship in the liberated Algeria after they won their national liberation struggle, but hardly any of them chose to accept it.
They went back to France.
Yeah.
Actually, it's very interesting that, because you see, I do see a parallel, and I'll tell you what it is. First of all, don't forget that the French have a mother country. They do. And so when the Algerians made that very extremely generous offer, they knew that nobody was going to end up stateless. They would go back to France or wherever, because they were still French. So that's one difference, let's say, between our situation in Israel. But where I see the similarity is that a large number of these French colonists who had been, settlers really, decided to leave and to go and find their lives elsewhere.
You see, their colonial privilege was more important to them.
Absolutely. But this is exactly the point of similarity with the situation in Israel, because what you have are people who have grown accustomed to enjoying all the advantages of colonialism without the cost. I mean, wonderful. Where else are they going to get that? Now, when the Arabs, as they call them, come along and say, okay, let's live together in equality, it's anathema to many of people like this on the Jewish side. Anathema. They despise Arabs. They look down on them. The idea that they would live with them in equality is absolutely abhorrent. They would leave. That's my point. We're not asking for anybody to leave, but that is what would in effect happen. People with dual nationality will try and make their way back to Western countries. And that will leave behind, as I've explained in the book, a population of poor Jews, religious Jews, and hardy souls who refuse to accept what's happening but hang on in the hope that it will change. That's what I think will happen.
The two-state solution, meanwhile, is still paraded about by Western leaders as a way to kick the can down the road, continue the status quo. How can you assess its popularity by civil society at this point in time, and what will it take for this charade to finally be put to rest?
Yes, thank you for asking that. That's a very important and interesting question. You see, you have to ask what's really going on when a political solution was proposed decades ago and got nowhere on the ground. But on the contrary, the conditions for its realization have vanished because there's not enough land left, the land is not contiguous, and so it's even on those grounds alone, it's not doable. However, as you say, people cling to it, particularly Western leaderships, Western politicians, they cling to this for dear life. Now, what is that about? Well, I think it's about, firstly, it's easier. It's easier for these people, rather than confront what they've helped create in the Middle East, a state like Israel, rather than confront that and understand that that has consequences. You see, if you go on talking about two states, then the aggrieved party, the Palestinians, get something and would be induced to keep quiet. And Israel can carry on as usual, although in a smaller geographical space, let's say. So that's very, very attractive, the idea of that. And that's what actually made it so popular from the beginning, that you could preserve this Zionist state and at the same time do something for the Palestinians so that they would stop getting together and doing intifadas and all these nasty things. So I think really that's what it was. However, I do feel there's something deeper than that, because you have to ask, all right, well, if that's fine for the reasons I've just said, you Western politicians, you support two states, fine. Now I'm demonstrating to you that it cannot physically happen. Just like, you know, you might say, I would like to have a Rolls Royce. And the answer comes back after a while, you're dreaming of this, and the answer comes back, no, not available. They don't make them anymore. And you go on saying, but I tell you, I want a Rolls Royce. Now, what's that about?
God promised me a Rolls Royce, right?
Even better, yes. But you see, I really think there's something psychological at the bottom of this. And I think Palestinians have to wise up, because something that Westerners cling to like this, despite the evidence, against the evidence, despite the injustice, all that stuff. What I think, and of course it's a suspicion, I can't prove it, is that deep inside, a lot of Europeans and Americans is an abiding sense of guilt about the Jews. Now, that's because, of course, the culmination of that was in the Holocaust, but it was before, in the historic persecution of Jews. That remains deeply inside a lot of people, and they feel badly about Jews. And they feel that the Jews, the least you can do is help them to live in their state, make sure that they're safe. I really cannot think of any other than this explanation. You can see that if something, I mean, they're not conscious of this. I'm not suggesting for a moment they're going around thinking this, but that's what I think animates this very strange phenomenon.
You talk a lot in your book. There's a really the longest chapter really is about a kind of history of different plans for Palestine, different plans of what's often called the one state solution. And you also talk about the binational state and how, you know, I find the section quite interesting where you're talking about some of the early Zionists were wanted to have a binational state within Palestine as a way really of having a foothold for their colonial project, really. And there's also something called parallel sovereignty. And you write in your book that you're not trying to make a blueprint, but could you maybe talk a little bit about the evolution of the one state idea and its history, and where do you think we've got to now?
Well, as you say, that chapter I felt it was very important for people to understand how these ideas have evolved, and they really have. I would say in the last 20 years, the idea of a democratic state, a one person, one vote state, has acquired much more prominence. It's not, unfortunately, it's not taken hold of opinion formers, of leaderships in the West, as it should have done. And that again, just I refer to my earlier answer about the two states, because of this deep guilt that then if you have a one democratic state, that's the end of Israel, actually. That is something that there is a kind of a revulsion against. Anyway, despite that, the discussion of the one state, democratic state, has increased over the last 20 years as a number of groups have come into being trying to make it happen, and increasingly so, you know. But so really that I think is what is how it's happening. By national state does not solve this problem, because, well, first of all, the implication that you've got the idea is that you've got two equivalent nations, as it were, with equivalent rights, and each community or each nation, quote, looks after itself and is sort of autonomous with a kind of joint parliament for defense or things like that. It won't work, you see. It's not desirable. I'll tell you why. Because the Israel national state, half of this binationalism, would be Zionist. I mean, you know, there's no escaping from the fact that Zionism has to end.
A binational state would also be sectarian. It would be a sectarian state, and you know, we see the problems inherent in such an idea in a country like Lebanon, especially.
Absolutely. And in fact, when I've, you know, been through, I've described various models of countries that have got different communities. Belgium is a very good example. The fact is, if you're lucky, people can tolerate it and can get on, but more often than not, the whole thing breaks down. Now, in the case of Palestine, which has no equivalent, in my view, it has no precedent, it has no equivalent. It's really unique. We are discovering as we go along, and we're, you know, searching for a way out of this hideous tragedy. There's a limit. What I'm trying to say is there's a limit to how much one can apply other models. And you quite rightly raised the question of South Africa. And of course, one of the most important reasons why the situation in South Africa and in Palestine are fundamentally different is that the people who practiced apartheid, they wanted to exploit the blacks, to use them for all kinds of lowly paid laboring, etc., all these jobs. In the case of Palestine, the Zionists wanted to replace the Palestinians, want to expel them. They don't want them around at all, serving them or not serving them. So that's a very, very fundamental difference.
Liberal Zionists who decry the current outwardly fascistic government in Israel, you know, mourning the loss of, in quotations, Israel's soul, which of course has always been a deranged fantasy. They say that the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, is worthless, that international solidarity movements are hopeless, and that the only actors who can bring so-called peace and security, of course, for Israel, are international governments and courts and the powerful elite. What's missing from that equation, and how important are solidarity movements and the boycott movement and you know, people who take direct action to stop Israel's crimes?
Well, let me answer the last bit of your point. It's very, the BDS movement the solidarity movement for Palestine, direct action, whichever way people feel that they can express this, is very valuable, is very important for the Palestinians. The problem with the liberal Zionists is that they don't actually, whatever they say, they don't care about Palestinians. They like to appear civilized and humane and you know, we don't want to oppress anybody. But actually, if they thought about who Palestinians are and what they've been through, they could not adhere to the policies of a state which created all of that and which perpetuates it. So whether they're liberal and they appreciate art or something, it is really irrelevant for the Palestinians. It's quite useless. And in a way, you know, I have to tell you, liberal Zionists are a menace. They are a menace because they perpetuate this false presentation of Israel as some kind of civilized place, which, you know, appeals to Western liberal sensibilities, who think, well, these are really nice people, actually, and the state is quite nice, but they got a bad government, for example. You know, and you hear this a lot. So they are really are a menace. In a way, I have to say to you that Smotrich and et al. Are a breath of fresh air.
They're more honest. Absolutely. The mask is off. Exactly.
Yeah, they're saying the quiet part out loud.
Right. It's incredible. What do you see as the role of the so-called international community in terms of the single state inevitability?
I'm afraid that the international community, so-called, has been extremely disappointing where the Palestinians are concerned. Every time Israel commits a crime, and many of these crimes have been massive against an innocent population, the international community is absent. It does nothing. It doesn't matter what it says. It just doesn't do anything. And you see, I came to the conclusion that Palestinians, in order to have a future, have to do away with these illusions. There is no international community as far as they're concerned. There is no Western government which cares a hang about them, and therefore they're on their own, and they've you know, they've very often relied on international law, on the United Nations, the various sections of the United Nations, but it's never changed anything. Things just go on getting worse. So that's why I feel very strongly they have to take matters into their own hands. And if they do, it'll make a real difference. It's the only thing that will.
Gada Karmi, thank you so much for all of the work that you do. Your new book is brilliant and invaluable. It's called One State, The Only Democratic Future for Palestine. Israel will have links to that, to the book and how you can get it on the podcast post that accompanies this episode. Gada Karmi, thank you so much. And thanks for being with us again on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Are you a fan of the independent film news and interviews on The Film Show? Well, you won't want to miss the new and expanded Words and Pictures, coming in 2019. That's right, The Film Show and Words and Pictures are coming together to fill the airwaves with the most creative happenings and fertile minds in screencraft, stagecraft, comics, and animation. So tune in to KBOO twice a month, 11:30 a.m. every second and fourth Thursday in 2019 and beyond, for the very best of the narrative arts on the new Words and Pictures.